This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 1st, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, momentum builds to repeal the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision as voters in Colorado weigh in on corporate personhood. In the Philippines, environmentalists push to protect the threatened Manila Bay. And we'll hear from Haiti on the latest in the fight against cholera. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. In Syria today, there were massive rallies both for and against President Bashar al-Assad. At least four people were killed by security forces. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says that scores of civilians were arrested today, including 60 schoolchildren. Syria has also reportedly admitted to planting landmines along the Lebanese-Syrian border to deter refugees from fleeing the eight-month crackdown on anti-government protesters. Jackson Ellers has more from Beirut.
A Syrian man near the Lebanese border of Israel was reportedly the first victim of the new policy, losing a foot on Sunday after stepping on a recently planted landmine. Associated Press quoted a Syrian official as saying that Syria has, quote, undertaken many measures to control the borders, including planting landmines. Witnesses told AP that they had seen Syrian soldiers planting landmines on the border across from Lebanon's eastern Baalbek region. The continued exodus of Syrians fleeing to neighboring Turkey and Lebanon is proving an embarrassment for the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, whose government continues its brutal crackdown of anti-government protesters, calling for an end to Assad's rule. More than 5,000 Syrians have fled to Lebanon since March, and despite pressure from the United Nations and the Arab League, the Syrian regime shows no signs of letting up on the military crackdown of protesters. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Beirut, Lebanon.
There's still no response from Damascus about an Arab League proposal to end the violent repression of dissent in the country. According to the UN, at least 3,000 people have died in the 8 months of protests. Reports of events in Syria are impossible to verify. Foreign press remains barred from the country. And according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Syrian bloggers and journalists continue to disappear at an alarming rate. Three more went missing in the past 8 days. Unpiloted aircraft continue to fire airstrikes in Pakistan. According to the leader of an anti-drone campaign, two youth were among at least four people killed in North Waziristan last night. One of them, 16-year-old Tariq, took part just last Friday in an anti-drone rally in Islamabad. The drone attack that also killed Tariq's 12-year-old cousin was the fourth reported attack in 5 days. Despite early reports on Sunday that victims of another drone attack in the region were all militants, The Nation reports that at least four of them were local chromite miners. Dozens of anti-drone protesters who were arrested in April go before a Syracuse, New York judge today. The Hancock 38 staged a die-in at the entrance to the U.S. airbase from which Reaper drones are remotely piloted over Afghanistan. They're charged with refusing to comply with a police order and blocking traffic. A private in the U.S. Army was sentenced to 10 years in a South Korean jail today for raping a teenage girl. PFC Kevin Flippin was convicted of repeatedly attacking the girl after breaking into her room. U.S. forces in the region are now under a curfew. Students and teachers were back at school today in Bennington, Vermont, after both sides gave preliminary approval to the terms of a new 3-year contract Monday night. Carl Ettmeyer reports.
The 9-day strike ties the record for the longest in Vermont's history. The school district's 300-plus teachers had been working without a contract since June 2010. Darren Allen, spokesperson for the state teachers' union, said that just getting back to the framework of their previous agreement was one of the teachers' primary victories.
That was one of the most important factors that led to the strike, is that the boards did not want to negotiate based on their expired contract, but wanted to negotiate based on their own unilaterally imposed terms.
According to Allen, the side split down the middle an increase in teachers' contributions to health insurance premiums, and teachers will receive a pay hike in each of the next 3 years. No one from the school district was available immediately for comment. Carl Ettmeyer, FSRN, Montpelier, Vermont.
New sentencing guidelines go into effect today, and people already serving time under the old guidelines may see their stints shortened. The Fair Sentencing Act was passed last year, and this summer it was made retroactive. The law aimed to balance sentences meted out for crack versus powdered cocaine. How many will walk free today is not clear, but some 1,900 people qualified for immediate release. The Supreme Court heard arguments today in a case about prisoners' rights. The question is whether an inmate at a privately run federal prison has the same rights as one in a government-run institution. While an inmate in a privately run prison, Richard Pollard says he was denied adequate medical care and subjected to painful shackles after he broke his arm. His lawyers say he should have the same right to seek judicial relief as he would if he were in a publicly run prison. And Bank of America capitulated in the face of public outcry, account closures, and a threatened bank run, announcing today that they will not charge a $5 debit card fee after all. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. A group of Democratic senators, including Tom Udall, Chuck Schumer, and Dick Durbin, have introduced a constitutional amendment that would reverse the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. That 2010 ruling paved the way for corporations and special interests to spend unlimited amounts in elections. The legislation introduced today would allow Congress the authority to regulate the campaign finance system. Lawmakers have unsuccessfully introduced similar bills in the past, but there's growing momentum to respond to the Citizens United ruling. That's apparent in Colorado, where corporations trying to defeat local ballot measures are spending a record amount of money. That, in turn, is driving grassroots support of an anti-corporate personhood ballot measure, Maeve Conran reports.
In Boulder, Colorado, voters are deciding whether to form a municipalized utility and break from the energy giant Xcel Energy. Xcel has largely funded a nearly $1 million no-vote campaign, making it the most expensive political issue in city history.
The city is trying to or asking citizens for the right to be able to create and sell its own electricity and to take that right away from the corporations, but to do it themselves. And a huge amount of money is being spent against that campaign, much more than local citizens could raise.
That's Judy Lubau, one of the organizers of another ballot issue, one which calls for amending the U.S. Constitution to establish that only human beings, not corporations, are entitled to constitutional rights. The rise of corporate influence on elections in the wake of the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling prompted Lubau to try to get an anti-corporate personhood measure on the ballot.
In my opinion, Congress is bought. And the presidency is almost fatally compromised. We can't seem to get real change no matter who's elected. And that being so, one of the few places where we can impact anything is locally. So we can make an impact in local government, and that's why Move to Amend is choosing to do local actions.
Move to Amend is pushing similar measures across the country, including one that passed in Madison, Wisconsin this past April. In August, Boulder City Council voted 6-3 to put the measure on the ballot. Councilmember Matt Applebaum initially rejected the idea, but ultimately changed his mind.
I mean, this is kind of fundamental to democracy at all levels. So it is a local issue, and it's a state issue, and it's a national issue. And when I realized that, it became obvious that the right thing to do was to put this on the ballot.
Lubau and the other campaign supporters say they've seen firsthand how corporations have spent huge amounts of money to influence local elections.
I've seen locally that our local elections are impacted by the fact that the Supreme Court has given corporations the alleged constitutional right of free speech to spend unlimited funds. So even before Citizens United, it was still very, very difficult to control corporate and large donor expenditures. And I've seen that in Longmont in 2009, that's a city right next to Boulder.
2 years ago, Longmont voters were asked to reinstate the city's right to offer telecommunications services to its residents. A 2005 state law prohibits the city from using its existing fibre optic network for residents unless voters approve it. The telecommunications industry, including Comcast and Quest, funded a Vote No campaign, spending about $250,000 defeating the measure. According to Vince Jordan, who is working on the Yes campaign, that record-breaking spending has already been surpassed this year with a similar measure on the ballot.
In Longmont's 100-year history, 2 years ago in 2009, they broke two records, the guys that are campaigning against this. It was the single largest sum of money ever spent on a single issue, and also the largest amount of money ever spent on a single election in Longmont's 100-year history. They're going to break both of those records. They've already broken both of those records this time. So, you know, wow.
The telecommunications industry has spent millions of dollars trying to block similar measures in other communities like Monticello, Minnesota, and Lafayette, Louisiana, according to Ken Fellman, an attorney working with the city of Longmont on their ballot issue.
What you're seeing in Longmont, I have seen in other communities around the country as well. And I think it truly is a David versus Goliath kind of an issue when these issues come up in local communities.
In both cities, grassroots activists are hoping voters will send a clear message to corporations seeking to influence local elections. Along with Boulder, Missoula, Montana will have an anti-corporate personhood measure on this year's ballot. Communities in Oregon and California are in the early stages of a similar campaign. Maeve Conran, FSRN, Boulder, Colorado.
Back to Washington, D.C., where lawmakers on Capitol Hill are debating the future of the Environmental Protection Agency's powers to regulate air pollution. On Monday, the agency made a landmark ruling against a single stationary polluter in Pennsylvania. The case brings up the issue of pollution across state lines. Alice Olstein has the story.
A Pennsylvania coal plant was found guilty of violating the Clean Air Act standards of neighboring New Jersey and must clean up its act within 3 years. Nick Cifuentes of the Sierra Club's Northeast chapter calls the decision a major victory.
This is the first time that the EPA has actually granted one of these petitions on a single source polluter. And so that's something that's particularly good to know, that the EPA is really stepping up to the plate and saying, these plants are dangerous, and we need to do something about that.
In a lengthy report released Monday, the EPA ruled that pollution from GenOn's coal plant in Upper Mount Bethel Township was blowing across state lines and impacting the air quality of several New Jersey counties. In 2009, the plant's sulfur dioxide emissions were more than twice that of all of New Jersey's power plants combined. Now, the plant must cut its sulfur dioxide levels by 60% within a year and 81% within 3 years. GenOn has 2 months to appeal the decision. New Jersey began petitioning for this ruling over a year ago. This morning, the Republican Governor Chris Christie praised the EPA's decision, and Larry Raganese of the state's Environmental Protection Department says it's an important measure for New Jersey residents.
It's a public health issue because you have people who have respiratory problems. They have asthma. It could cause respiratory failure. You know, this is material that people are breathing in, and it's not a good thing.
New Jersey drew criticism from environmental advocates earlier this year for withdrawing from the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, a cap-and-trade program between 10 northeastern states. But the state continues to push forward with massive offshore wind projects, solar farms on old landfills, fleets of electric cars, and stricter standards on diesel, while still using its legal resources to sanction neighboring polluters whose toxins don't respect state lines. New Jersey's air pollution standards are much stricter than Pennsylvania's, a disparity the federal EPA hopes to address with higher standards across the board. In May, the EPA released a set of proposed rule changes limiting carcinogens and greenhouse gas emissions from certain industrial boilers and incinerators. But strong opposition from individual states, House Republicans, and big business has slowed implementation. One of the EPA's most vocal opponents, Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, aired his grievances in a congressional hearing Tuesday.
The rule will have a huge economic impact on this nation. First, it'll increase electricity prices over the course of the next 5 to 10 years of between 10% and 35%, and that can be a financial death blow for businesses struggling to meet payroll and families on fixed incomes. Second, retrofitting power plants to meet the standards will, as you all know, be prohibitively expensive. So there's no question that certain plants will close and the nation's electricity supply will decrease.
The Sierra Club's Nick Cifuentes disagrees with Cuccinelli's assessment of the regulations and says Republican attacks on the EPA don't take all factors into account.
There was a recent study that was put out by Middlebury College, and that study found that in the case of coal-fired power plants, they actually cost more in terms of the human health impacts than they generate for the economy. They are actually economically holding us back. It's not just about human health, it's also about human wealth.
24 state attorney generals are challenging the new rules. Several pending cases in the U.S. Court of Appeals are also forcing the EPA to review and reconsider its latest standards, and a final ruling won't come down until April of next year. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. For our archives, documentaries, and specials, go to FSRN.org, where you can learn more about how to support grassroots global journalism. Known for its picturesque sunsets, Manila Bay in the Philippines covers more than 700 square miles near the country's capital. But the bay has experienced decades of pollution, and environmentalists are calling on the government to do more to protect a valuable ecosystem that provides livelihood for many city residents. Madonna Varola reports from Manila.
An estimated 23 million people live around the natural harbor of Manila Bay, but decades of urbanization and industrialization have ravaged this natural resource. One problem, says Ruperto Sabihon, is the garbage. He's a member of international champion Philippine Dragon Boat Team and knows this body of water intimately.
Amoy, yung amoy ng dagat. Ibang amoy.
Garbage is a big problem on and off the bay. In the evening, people throw much of their garbage into the bay. Most of it is plastic. There's even a dead body floating in the water. The bay is polluted. The smell is awful, but we're used to it. Children are getting sick.
Bukod pa yung nandoon sa dagat nakalutang, pag magsagwan ka nga, karamihan plastic.
More than 1,000 people recently descended on the bay to help clean it up. Leon Dulce with the Kalikasan People's Network for the Environment helped organize the effort.
Manila Bay is a very critical ecosystem. It's one of our major fishing bays. The Battle of Manila Bay was a historic moment in the Philippine history when the colonial Spaniards were driven away by American forces in cooperation with the Filipino revolutionaries. But it's experiencing rapid degradation from the 70s up to now.
Over the last few decades, land reclamation projects have dramatically changed the bay's banks. Large private and government buildings have been constructed, as well as condos, a soccer stadium, and the world's third largest shopping mall. Ferdinand Hicap is national chair of Fisher Folk Group Pamalakaya. He says what's killing the bay is development aggression.
The industries around the bay dump their garbage on the bay. The government should strictly implement a law that prohibits garbage dumping, or the bay will completely die from industries.
Some observers say the government has put economic development over environment protection. Activist Leon Dulce says partnerships with private companies are destroying the bay's ecosystem.
For the past three decades, we've lost 70% of our mangrove areas in the entire Philippines, especially here in NCR, where the Las Piñas Bird Sanctuary is actually one of the... It's a 175-hectare mangrove area, and it's actually one of the only remaining mangrove areas here in the NCR. And it's also under threat of, again, reclamation projects. They aim to... The Cyber Bay Corporation, in cooperation with the Philippine Reclamation Authority, they aim to reclaim the area and put up an ambitious business center. So again, there's the clash of interest.
But others blame residents too. Noel Gerlan is director of the government's Manila Bay Coordinating Office. He says people who live nearby contribute significantly to the problem.
The indiscriminate dumping of solid waste. We have a high number of informal settlers living along waterways that discharges directly into the waterways. They practically use the waterways as their toilets. About 170,000 families, even in the 1960s, in fact. It's already a known fact that people should not settle along waterways. It's a danger area. People from the provinces see Manila as a haven for everything.
The Supreme Court in 2008 ordered government agencies to coordinate in cleaning up the bay, including improving wastewater and sewage treatment and implementing better oversight of ships, businesses, and homes. But environmental activist Leon Dulce has become cynical of the government, claiming there has been no genuine consultations with the grassroots.
In the reclamation projects, hundreds of thousands of Filipino people who live and in the fisheries of Manila Bay are not actually being upheld by the government. Instead of promoting and subsidizing programs and policies that develop our local fisheries industry, such as providing subsidies, fishing infrastructure, boats, nets, developing new technology for sustainable management of our coastal resources.
Fishermen have been hard hit, including Ferdinand Hicap, who struggled to make a living due to the bay's pollution.
Wala kaming ibang hiling at wala kaming ibang...
Our catch has dramatically dropped. This is the reason why we fisher folk have organized. We will not stop. We only wish for a simple and dignified life, that our children are able to go to school, and when they are sick, we can buy them medicines.
Isang bis, pitong linggo, baka dalawang araw lang yung...
The bay recently was hit with another problem following two deadly back-to-back typhoons. Garbage inundated the water, and the bay's seawall was severely damaged. Activists will have to organize another clean-up, and bay restoration programs might be put on hold as the country continues to respond to the recent flooding that killed more than 80 people and cost more than $300 million in damage. Madonna Virola, FSRN, Manila.
The World Health Organization warns that cholera cases in Haiti could reach 500,000 by the end of this year. Close to 6,600 people have died from cholera since an outbreak in 2010. 250,000 have been hospitalized, according to the WHO. Aid agencies are now saying that funds and resources specifically for cholera are drying up at a critical moment. The group Partners in Health was one of the first in Haiti to begin treating those with cholera, and it's announced plans to begin an oral vaccine program in January. Dr. Charles Patrick Almazor is director of clinical services in Haiti for Partners in Health. He also led efforts at the government hospital in St. Mark, which was the epicenter of the cholera epidemic when it began. Dr. Almazor, welcome to FSRN.
Oh, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Almazor, what has changed in the fight against the spread of cholera and in treating people from when the disease was first seen last year?
And what we have been seeing over time is like a lot of people, a lot of partners who have been helping us, like Partners in Health and also the government, to fight against cholera. A lot of them have been gone. So this is what we have noticed. I mean, we will say also we have fewer cases, but still cholera still represents a big burden in Haiti. And a lot of partners have left.
You mentioned partners who have left. Partners in Health has put that number at, they said in the beginning of 2011, there were 128 NGOs and government organizations working with cholera, but now the number is down to just 40. How does that affect the kind of treatment that you can offer to Haitians?
It does affect it. And in fact, when you used to receive like patients and just from one area, because at the beginning, other partners were helping in other areas, but now since they left, so all of the burden, like all of the people, they just come straight to our facilities. So this was the case in one of the city called Verret, when we had other partners helping, and now we are the only one, so the burden of cases like has increased.
Tell us a little more about that, about your efforts there in Verret. What is it like now? Do you have the resources you need, and the people who come in that need treatment, what are they like?
I mean, we still receive a lot of patients, but fewer severe cases. And when they are coming from very far, like in the mountains, walking from 6 to 8 hours coming to our facilities. still now we are okay with supplies and also staffing. We have doctors available and nurses to receive them when they come, and usually they come very sick. And I would say this is the plan. We do a lot of health promotions through our network of community health workers. They go there and also they talk to people, educate them about hand washing, about all the preventive measures, but still not enough.
The UN says only 30% of Haitians have access to sanitation facilities and that only 54% have access to safe drinking water. Now, as you're talking about these very important preventative measures, what about long-term solutions like public water and sanitation systems?
Actually, this is one of the things we are asking for. Not only we're asking for oral vaccine for people, but also a clear system, like good structure. But what we know so far, it took us like 200 years to have this this structure, just infrastructure for people, like latrine, like the basic social services. But we still don't have it. We don't know if we have to wait for another 10 years or 25 years to provide all those basic services in terms of water and sanitation to people. And in the meantime, I think a lot of people will die. So we support to have more, better infrastructure, more water, more access to water, more access to sanitation to people. But at the same time, having cholera vaccine just to prevent it in the short term.
We're now more than a year and a half after the 2010 earthquake that devastated parts of Haiti, and the country is still recovering. Following the earthquake, there was an outpouring of relief, of assistance coming from all over the world. Dr. Almasar, you are there on the ground level in Haiti, day in, day out, working with people who need attention, working with people who need assistance. What would you like to see this international aid and the money and the funds going to in order to make a difference in the kind of work that you do there?
I mean, it's still a lot of work to be done, like a lot of promises have been done, maybe also a lot of money, but I would say less than around 1% of this money went through the government, like to help the government to better respond to its citizens' needs. So I think more of this funding should go through the government via a better, like a transparent mechanism. And I would say not a lot of things has been done. If you go to Haiti, like you would think that the earthquake just happened, which is sad.
Dr. Charles Patrick Almasar is Director of Clinical Services in Haiti for Partners in Health. He spoke to us about the fight against cholera in the country. Dr. Almasar, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carisley. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. More information is available on our website at fsrn.org. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Thank you.